Today, we're joined by the well-known forecaster, strategist, and author Martin Armstrong at armstrongeconomics.com. We began speaking with Martin over 10 years ago, and during that time, he has made a long list of successful predictions and forecasts, not just on the stock market itself, but also on a wide range of various asset classes and political or geopolitical events. Martin offers a contrarian, outside-the-box perspective that often differs from the consensus view. And whether you agree or disagree with what he has to say, his framework is often very helpful in understanding how the global markets and economy actually function. So without further ado, we hope you enjoy today's conversation with Martin Armstrong. Earlier this year, Martin, when we spoke with you, it was just a couple months after Russia invaded Ukraine. You explained on our podcast how this was not going to be a limited conflict, but would ultimately spiral into World War III. Again, this was just a couple months after the war had started, and that was a very controversial forecast at the time. But clearly, I mean, things have continued to move in that direction, and it appears as if reality is aligning with the forecast that you gave back then. You also said that you thought an all-out international conflict would likely emerge in the 2023 timeframe, so next year. Is that still your forecast? And if so, is there anything in specific that you think gets us to there from where we are today, whether that be a tactical nuclear weapons strike or a new front opening up with another country, for example?
Well, we have to understand here. I mean, put all the propaganda aside, because both sides put out propaganda. It's not just Russia. You know, I've made an effort over the years to actually try to listen to world leaders, oppositions, whatever. I mean, you can't understand an opponent or whatever you want to call them unless you understand their thinking process. That is so critical. And I'm very familiar with the area. I know people on both sides, and there is no resolution. We have to understand Putin is the moderate guy. And you remove Putin, and the oligarchs aren't going to have any power. The old neocons will. All right. The same people that went after Yeltsin and tried to remove him to reestablish the USSR. Those people are the ones that are coming out talking about nuclear war. And Putin's come out several times and said, no, we need a balanced approach. You remove him, and this is going to get much worse. And people have to understand it's propaganda, and this is how they do it. They demonize the head of a state. So then what happens is you then set the stage for justifying war. So I'm very concerned that it appears we have the worst group of world leaders possible in the West. I mean, Biden is a joke, but I mean, you look everywhere else, it's the same thing. There isn't one world leader who's standing up and saying peace. I mean, I've been at this for 40 years. I mean, usually every person, every president has sought to further world peace.
Well, in this case, peace, as Putin was trying to apparently negotiate before the war started, before the invasion, was that NATO would back up to its original lines, right, and withdraw. I don't know how feasible that was. It seemed like that was setting a pretty high bar, something that the West was not willing to do. This is my understanding of looking into some of the events that took place leading up to the war. But let's put that aside just for now and say, at least for the time being, and please feel free to clarify, it sounds like the negotiation terms for peace at this point would be to give up those annexed territories where the vote had ostensibly taken place, siding with Russia, and then also make sure that Crimea is just labeled to be part of Russia as well.
Yes, I mean, and that is not unreasonable. There was the Minsk Agreement, which Ukraine had signed on to. And you can Google this one. When the revolution took place, the Donbas area wanted to separate themselves back then. And the Minsk Agreement stated that they were to allow that area to take a vote and to seek separation. All right. They're not Ukrainians. They are primarily Russians there. And you also have to understand right up to the river, which is divides Ukraine in half. That whole eastern part was always Russia. And I'm talking about going back to the Tsar period. All right. So before the USSR, I can tell you that the only reasonable solution is fine. You don't want to believe the votes. Let the UN go in and all Western nations supervise the votes. They're going to vote to be with Russia. They're Russians.
And that's what Elon Musk had proposed, right? I mean, basically that idea, you'd have an international body that would oversee the voting. And depending on which way they vote. However, we should note that because of the fighting that's been taking place there for many years now, like you said, going all the way back to 2014 and prior to then, of course, there's been a lot of Ukrainians that have already moved out. So the people that are largely in that area are going to be more pro-Russian. The Western Ukrainian side is much more European. It's the Eastern side that sides more with Russia. So it likely would go to Russia, even if it was a neutral vote, quote unquote, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, but I mean, they are ethnic Russians to begin with. But you have to understand that there is this seething hatred in Ukraine of Russians. And it goes back, you can watch a movie called Mr. Jones.
Yeah, to the Holodomor, right?
Yes, and that was Stalin, all right? And Stalin, basically, communism was failing, so he stole all the food from Ukraine, and 7 million of them died. So it's understandable why they would hate Russians. That's simply the way it is. I mean, I can tell you in Kiev, you better not bring a bottle of Russian vodka to dinner. It's an insult. It's that bad. So these, like I said about Ukraine, I mean, in Serbia and stuff, these hatreds go back centuries. We're not going to get them, everybody play nice in the sandbox here. It's not going to happen.
Right.
You can't replace those family traditions and hatred that goes back so long.
Yeah. And just for a clarification here, historically wise, for any people that aren't familiar with these events, the Holodomor, which is known as the Terror Famine or the Great Famine, that had taken place under Stalin when Ukraine was part of Russia. And figures put it that there was anywhere between 3 to 5 million had died during that famine, or as high as 10 million. So it depends on which figures you look at. But there was millions of people that were killed during this famine. And like you said, in the movie that was based on this historical event, Stalin was basically just seizing Ukraine's grain, which they're considered the breadbasket for Europe, that commodity, and taking it back to Moscow to feed the population there. And because of that, many Ukrainians have very, like you said, a deep hatred or feeling as if, you know, they were betrayed, or some say that it was a form of genocide, but mass starvation that occurred under Stalin. And so that's why that goes back. And then it wasn't when Nazi Germany had risen, Ukraine had sided with Nazi Germany against the Soviet Union because of that event, in many cases, that was the root cause, because they wanted to basically punish Russia for what they did to them for that famine.
Yes, it is very deep. I mean, we have one girl that worked for us from Kiev. When I say, you know, don't you think some sort of compromise? The response is, you don't understand. If we compromised and gave them the Donbass, then they would come for the rest of the country.
Right. That is the belief. Yeah.
That's just simply, you know, then the person that actually translated our film, the forecaster for into Russian, she was from the Donbass region. So, I mean, we have people that have been on our staff from both sides as well.
Yeah. I have a friend that came from Ukraine. He lives here now. But he lived with his grandfather, who was alive during that time, who shares stories about how they resorted to cannibalism during that time, and the hatred that they have for Russia, for what happened. And they definitely blame Stalin. They definitely blame communism. Again, this was a huge part of why Ukraine had sided with Nazi Germany in agreeing to fight against Russia for that reason. That's just how far back these things go. But it was a terrible event, of course, and they don't trust Russia. Many on the western side, we should say, of Ukraine do not trust Russia. There's, like you said, a little bit more of a pro-Russian sentiment on the eastern side in these breakaway regions. So let's go back to this, because it sounds like, you know, in order to negotiate some sort of peace here, we would have to see those breakaway regions be seen internationally, not just by Ukraine, but internationally also as part of legitimately Russia after this vote that had taken place. The UN had just taken a vote, and I think it was 143 nations that said they do not recognize those territories as part of Russia. So even the international community is not. There's only five, I believe, that cited, including North Korea, Syria, Nicaragua, but a very, very small minority that recognized those annexed regions. So it doesn't appear as if peace, at least as far as what Russia is wanting to secure for peace, that that's not going to happen, which again means that we're probably looking at a World War III scenario here. And as you said before, 2023 was the time frame. So I guess my question to you is, what gets us from where we are today to there? What sort of events do you think we are going to see between now and then?
My greatest concern is Putin is removed from power, because I also have very good contacts in Russia. And in fact, I can tell you that there has been a long scholarly debate in Moscow who's really Russian, because Stalin was from Georgia and Khrushchev and Brezhnev were, I guess, from the Donbass, really. So is that Ukraine or was that Russia? Who knows? And so it's been who's really Russian has been a scholarly debate in Russia to begin with. So like they feel that they've been prejudiced by some of these crazy people on the outside. Khrushchev was removed because he created the almost a world war with his Cuban missiles nonsense. And there's a movie out on that too called The Courier, I would recommend. But that's my main concern, because Putin really is moderate, but he's also nostalgic. And this has been his problem, why he's been criticized in Russia behind the closed doors from the neocons. Russia actually began there in Kiev. That was their first capital. That's where the Rus' were. And they were basically defeated by the Mongol invasion in 1240. So eventually they reappeared and created Moscow. So to them, Kiev is, I would say not to all, but to Putin, Kiev was kind of like like London is to us. So that's why if he was really going to invade Ukraine, all right, the first thing you do in military tactics is you take out the power grid, you take down the communications, then you go after the water supply. It's standard military practice. The fact that he has not done that shows two things. One, he had no intention of taking Ukraine, only the Donbass. So he didn't lie about that. But the other problem is that's what opens him up to criticism inside Russia, that he's been too soft on Ukraine. And so my concern is that those powers will be far more aggressive than Putin has. Putin has not nuked Kiev, because that would be like London to us. Whereas the neocons, they don't care.
And you're talking about the war hawks within Russia itself.
Yes.
Yeah. When you say,
I mean, the same thing, we have neocons here too. I mean, like Bolton, okay. Et cetera.
Got it.
And I mean, they would not think twice about nuking Kiev.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, because like you're saying with Putin, you know, his first tactic, it seemed, as was to take Kiev and then use that as a negotiating position for securing these breakaway regions, the Donetsk, Luhansk, the Donbass region, that was the original aim. He was unable to move fully into Kiev and take it. So then they had to pull back to now the regions that they've annexed or are attempting to annex. And now it's a question of whether or not they're going to be able to succeed in that as the fighting is still continuing in those areas. But like you said, he didn't go after the critical infrastructure first. They are doing that now.
Because he's coming under pressure from the neocons.
Right. Which is one thing that I love to have you on our show to talk about, because you take almost a completely different view from what you'll often hear. And in this case, you're saying, you know, many people are saying if we remove Putin, if Putin gets removed from office, that will end the war. But what you're saying is no, that's actually probably a worst case scenario, because then in that case, you're going to have the more militant, more aggressive war hawks within Russia rise to power from the vacuum that's created. And then that will even accelerate moves towards World War III, if I got that correct.
Yes. I mean, you have to understand that the propaganda that has been leveled against Russia is driving a stake right through the heart of their culture. It's basically saying that they are worthless. You are rejecting any idea that they are worth respect, and you're undermining the dignity of the country. And when you do that, You basically make everybody there your enemy. I mean, I can tell you that the propaganda is just endless. You have this guy, Bill Browder, running around and saying, oh, Putin's the richest guy in the world. He's got $200 billion. And when you press him, he says, oh, he made the oligarchs give him 50% of their money. Complete lie. All right. I have all the documents. There was a meeting, and all he told them was, stay out of politics, and I'll leave you with your assets. That was it. There's another book out that basically even confirmed that Baranovsky tried to bribe Putin, and he rejected the money. First of all, if he took 100% of all the money of the oligarchs, he wouldn't reach $200 billion.
This brings up an interesting question because, like you said, you know, Putin basically made a deal with the oligarchs and said, if you don't enter into politics, I'll essentially leave you alone, right? If that's the case, what has been the cause of all of these Russian oligarchs that are dying? I mean, it seems like every month or almost every week you're hearing new news about a new Russian oligarch that's mysteriously died. Who's doing this? Most people would say it's Putin doing this to eliminate any potential competition if he were to get overthrown, to eliminate that possibility. What are your thoughts on that?
No, trust me, no oligarch. He would have to be out of his mind if he thought that he could possibly step in there and replace Putin. What you're looking at are basically the neocons that are kind of reducing the field a little bit.
Well, because many of these people have spoken out against the war or said that, you know, we want to see peace, that have been killed. Not all of them, but a number of them have. And I mean, their wives, their children have been killed in some cases. So it's, you know, so you're saying it's the war hawks again. It's the people behind Putin.
Yeah, and I can tell you that, I mean, look, my contacts are very extensive. The head of the Democratic Party there in Russia, Galina, her son worked in our London office. All right. She was assassinated by Primakov, the hardliners over there. And you could tell immediately what they said was, oh, well, she was a puppet of a Western financier who was supposed to be me. I mean, just simply because her son worked in our office. That was it. All right. I wasn't advising her on overthrowing the neocons or whatever. She was part of the democratic movement.
And she got killed off by
Primakov, in my opinion. I mean, because she was going to run for the election there and was overwhelmingly would have been elected.
And sorry, Primakov was who exactly?
Primakov was a former prime minister. He was the real head of the KGB.
Got it. Okay. So he's part of the Warhawk side that you're talking about.
Yeah, he was basically probably like our John McCain, the leader of the pack, so to speak. But, you know, there are others over there. And the same thing you have in China. No matter what country you go to, you have, you know, internally you have war hawks and you have, you know, those that don't. I mean, you have to understand that we have our own can of worms. And sure. Every country does. And that's why I'm saying about Putin, trust me, he is not the worst of the worst. He's just not.
He's the moderate, as you said. So again, going back to this idea, I mean, as you said earlier this year, just a couple months after the war started, you said this was the beginning of World War III. You thought that 2023 was the time frame where we would see this international all-out, you know, war manifest starting next year. That's only a couple months from now at this point. So we're getting closer to that. It seems like things just continue to escalate, as we talked about already. I mean, Putin now, Russia deciding that they're going to start taking out critical infrastructure. We've seen blackouts now across Ukraine. There was a big volley of missile strikes that took place just in the most recent weeks across major cities all over Ukraine, western and eastern side. So things are certainly not getting better. They're getting worse. And of course, that was retaliation for taking out the bridge, is what they say. You said worst case scenario is Putin actually gets overthrown. And then we see the war hawks come up who decide, hey, we do want to move forward with nuclear war, that perhaps Putin is putting a lid on that. I want to relate this back to something that you discussed as it relates to some market strategy here, and that's particularly with commodities, because again, when we spoke with you earlier this year, you said how if we do see this, if we're moving closer and closer towards World War III, as you believed we would, that this is going to exacerbate the commodity cycle and the shortages that we're looking at in a number of key commodities. So what do you see in terms of commodity shortages in the commodity bull market? It's seen a little bit of a reprieve given concerns over demand destruction and recession and things like that. But what do you see with commodities long term now?
Well, we're in what you would call more of a stagflation, where we're getting the inflation because of the shortages. And again, we have this problem with these climate change zealots. And they're just more interested in destroying our infrastructure to be able to produce energy. That's all they're concerned about. All right. And they think somehow, some way, well, then the alternatives will come into play. What happens between that and waiting for alternatives? People die. They freeze to death. It's just absolute insanity. But, you know, all they care about is this. You had the head of the Greens in Germany said, okay, fine, I'll allow you to keep the three nuclear plants open, but no new rods, and they have to close by April of next year. And he gets a standing ovation. And then the government puts out a book, How to Cook Without Electricity. I mean, it's, you know, they're just really destroying everything that has been built for world peace since World War II. It seems as though, you know, the real thing they have known about, and I've been in countless meetings with governments over the last 30 years, warning them this is coming. All right, you can't keep borrowing year after year after year with no intention of ever paying anything back. The problem is, you talk to them and I said, look, this is all going to fall apart. Well, how long do you think? I said, well, I give it maybe 20 years. Oh, okay, fine. Well, I won't be around by then. From their perspective, I understand politics. If I was to run for president and I say, vote for me because I saved your jobs, you're going to look at me like, how do I know I would have lost it? All right. It's far better you lose your job. And then I say, vote for me, I'll get the guy that did it. That's politics. There's no, you know, I've gotten very disgusted with it because it doesn't matter what you do. You cannot get around to actually managing the economy in a proper way. So what's happening here with this whole Klaus Schwab thing, and when he's really saying you'll own nothing and be happy, what he's really doing is trying to make it sound like, look, we're going to default on all the debt, but we're doing it for you, not for us. Because by defaulting on the debt, all the pension funds go. Social Security is 100% U.S. government bonds. So then you have the central banks lowered interest rates. ECB lowered interest rates to negative in 2014. They never considered, gee, what would happen to the pension funds? All the pension funds in Europe are completely wiped out. So this is not going to be, you know, a walk in the park, and there's no return to normal here. Unfortunately, I think that the people behind the curtain there know this, and what they're doing is they're cheering on war, but they think it's going to be conventional. And by doing so, that will give them the excuse to default on this debt, reestablish a new Bretton Woods, and this new digital currency that they want to create. And, you know, I think they're totally insane. They have no understanding of what they're doing. And in a time of war, if you really want to see Russia take Europe, all it has to do is send three missiles, take out the power, you know, three power stations, the whole grid goes down, and Europe is in the dark. It has no internet, no communications. And guess what? If you really had all digital currency, everybody's broken. You can't even leave your house if you got an electric car. This is a disaster.
Taking down the electrical grid is probably worst case scenario for our modern society. I mean, that's just unthinkable today as to what would happen, just given the dependencies we have.
Exactly. I mean, we've become extremely vulnerable. And for the life of me, I mean, I think this is complete insanity to keep pushing for war and thinking you're going to be able to do another Bretton Woods and make this all nice and happy afterwards. It's just not going to work that way.
Yeah. And my framework is that it's less that people are proactively trying to pull all these strings for some larger outcome, but mostly they're reactionary in nature and limited in their foresight. That's my particular bias. But of course, there are agendas at play. And we understand that. I mean, there's a global environmental agenda that's been launched over the past 10 years that's very much anti-fossil fuels, which has led to a lack of investment going into refineries, into our fossil fuel infrastructure. And that's led us up to where we are today. The Russia-Ukraine war has certainly exacerbated that situation. But again, going back to commodities, it sounds like the message here is that if we do see a World War III type scenario emerge next year, which was your forecast when we spoke with you last time, that's going to make the shortages worse and probably drive prices even higher if we don't see some type of peace or negotiation.
Yes. I mean, as far as World War III, we're probably not looking at that until 25 to 27 period. And that would be most likely when we're looking at China, North Korea, Iran, etc., coming together behind Russia. What we're looking at is China's not stupid. These people think that they can take down Russia and then they're going to turn on China. There has been some discussion that the U.S. wanted Xing to get lifetime. You sent over Pelosi and all this nonsense before the election.
Before the party Congress that just took place?
Yeah. I mean, why did she hop on a plane and go over there and do that? I mean, that was the exact worst possible thing you can do because you had to understand that would be the reaction. China's not stupid. They know that you take out Russia and then we're turning on them. It's just the way it is. We got to get rid of a lot of these old people that have just been around for too long, actually. So I'm more concerned that what you're going to see is, yes, softness initially. When things get really start turning up, and I would be very concerned about Putin being removed from power. The earliest I could see would be the first week of November this year, probably more likely maybe April, unless he's willing to start nuking things. I think they will replace him. Then we're going to have a problem. Then what happens if they nuke Kiev just with a tactical nuke and then say, OK, fine, who's next? Are all the people going to say, yeah, let's go get them, or and watch New York and Washington vanish? I understand their strategy. Would the U.S. and NATO go all the way in if they took out Kiev? It's a very interesting question. And that's what their neocons look at. And so my concern is that they get a hold of power. Ever since the very beginning, I mean, they, like I said, they staged a coup against Gorbachev. All right. To them, when NATO offered Russia to join in 91, to them, they saw that as Russia surrendering to the United States, that it would no longer be a respectful country, it would be just a mere vassal state. And you have to understand their thinking process. You know, that's the way they think, and that's the way they're going to look at it. It doesn't mean it's right or wrong. That's irrelevant. It was one thing my father always taught me. He said, it's not what you think, it's what the other side thinks, because that's what's going to make them act. So, I mean, I think we have to try to understand the thinking process on the other side and not just apply our own ideas, because that's not going to work.
Another thing that you had said that I thought was very counterintuitive, especially to the perhaps reigning narrative, is that, you know, the Fed hiking rates, that they need to be hiking rates because obviously inflation is out of control. And you had said that this is essentially making the situation that we see with commodities facing shortages, especially in the energy complex, of course, where it's most acute, that that's actually making things worse and that basically the economic establishment has it completely backwards. Can you share your thoughts on that?
The Fed has only one model. That's it. Raise interest rates to bring down inflation because it's based on speculation. And that's just not true. Sometimes we're dealing with something much the opposite, which right now it's shortages. And that was set in motion by COVID. People couldn't drive around. They couldn't deliver things. I mean, I got emails from farmers that had to kill 30,000 chickens because they couldn't get on the market. Another farmer sent me photographs that he was plowing his entire potato crop underground, couldn't get it to market. So you created shortages. I go to the supermarket, one day there's no eggs. 2 days later, they're back, all right? I never saw that in my entire life, all right? So raising interest rates in this type of an environment of shortages only exacerbates the shortages. We're not dealing with a speculative boom.
Because it's the cost of capital that's now going up, and businesses are going to have a harder time raising capital in order to invest in the necessary infrastructure production, right?
Yeah. I mean, we've done studies, we've published them on our site, and the stock market has never peaked at the same level of interest rates twice. Why? Because it's the interest rate basis expectations. If you think you're going to double your money, you'll pay 20%. But if you don't think you're going to make 1%, you're not going to pay 1%. So the level of interest rates is irrelevant. It has to be cast against the expectations of the future. And as long as people see recession that we are in is stagflation, and that is declining into probably the first quarter of next year, then why, you know, is somebody going to go borrow? People are not that stupid. You know, a lot of people, real estate, you know, before I had said, look, real estate will start rising with the first rate hike. They said, oh, that's absurd, blah, blah, blah. I said, people are not stupid, all right? As soon as they saw mortgage rates start to tick up, they immediately went out and started buying. As long as they think if it's going to be cheaper next month, why go buy it now? They're not that dumb, all right? It just seems to be the analysts are dumb. What can I say? But you know, even my mother ran out and bought, you know, 10-year CDs in 1981 at 20%. My mother said, 20% for 10 years? Of course, I've never seen that in my life. She she did the high. She bought the high right on target. Wow. So sometimes the average person is far smarter than the pundits.
Yeah, you know, what we've been saying is, as you noted, you know, when we think about the global supply chain pressures, the fact that, you know, China is still practicing zero COVID, that that's putting a crimp on the amount of supplies that they're able to produce. We see the Russia-Ukraine war, all of these things that are influencing the shortages that we see. We 10 years of non-investment into the energy complex to not build up our refinery capacity, to not invest in necessary production, so that we now have major short supplies of all of the key commodities that we need. You know, all of these things together, the Fed has very, very little to no influence on all of this when we're talking about the supply side. They do have an impact on the demand side, of course. And so they're heavily trying to impact the demand side. But it seems like just kind of what Janet Yellen had said when she was Fed chair, where she had explained that the government, U.S. government, really needs to do its part on the fiscal side in order to promote growth. I believe that's what Fed Chair Powell needs to do today. He needs to say very clearly, hey, our raising interest rates only can do so much to squash inflation. But we need to look at the policies that are being pursued on the fiscal side, on the regulatory side, that are causing higher inflation. So put the focus back onto the U.S. government. And in that case, we need to be looking at anti-fossil fuel policies and what we're doing there.
Well, you know, Biden, when he was running for office, said he will end fossil fuels. And that's what he basically set out to do.
Yeah, he said he wasn't joking. He said, this isn't hyperbole. I'm going to do it.
And I mean, I got a clip on our site where he's telling to a girl, he says, look in my eyes. I promise you I will end fossil fuels. All right. You know, it's very nice. But the most conservative study I've seen, if everybody had electric cars, the power grid has to be at least four times the size. The most worst forecasts are it has to be 10 times. So we're nowhere close to being able to do this. It's terrible. I mean, I live in Florida. If you've got an electric car and there's a hurricane, sorry, you're not going anywhere.
Yeah.
Where do you get 200 miles? That's not going to be very far.
I think people are really waking up to the fact that solar, wind, renewable energies, they're too intermittent. You need to have 24/7 base load power, which that's hydroelectric. If there is one renewable, hydroelectric does that. Nuclear does that. Oil and gas. Those are the things that provide base load power. Solar and wind does not work when it's not sunny enough and when it's not windy enough. And there's long periods where we just don't get enough sun, enough wind to power our society 24/7. It's just reality.
Look, you can go back and you can Google it. The first Clean Air Act was in 561 AD. The Emperor Justinian, because everybody was using wood. All right. And the people on the apartment on the second floor were complaining that the smoke from the first floor came up into their apartment. So it was he passed the Clean Air Act. First time. So, I mean, it doesn't matter. I mean, you know, you burn wood, that's CO2. We've been doing this for you know, thousands of years. You're not going to get rid of CO2. And if you did, then the planet would be a complete desert. Plants need CO2 to live on.
The problem is, too, as Jamie Dimon has been speaking pretty loudly about, is the fact that because we didn't invest in oil and gas and tried to move away from oil and gas, we've now seen major shortages emerge, leading all these nations, both rich and poor, to go back to coal, reversing all of the efforts that were made to reduce carbon production. So it just completely backfired.
Yeah. I mean, look, I lived in London in 1985, and all the buses were diesel. All right. And you'd have to hold your breath when you walked past one. All right. They switched from the diesel. Okay, great. It's now, you know, you can walk around London. You don't have to hold your breath. But, you know, it's, you know, we have to understand that a lot of this is just absolute nonsense. Like I said, you have the head of the Green Party over there saying even nuclear has to be shut down. I mean, what are you going to do? Just keep rubbing two sticks together or something? I mean, I don't, you know, it's just, you know, you have people just indoctrinated with ideas that are not total nonsense. And I'm very concerned about, you know, the death toll in Europe among the elderly this year, and they'll probably blame it on COVID or something rather than lack of heat.
So let's talk about your market outlook. Basically, what we're talking about here is things are likely going to be escalating moving forward, that we are looking at things getting worse into 2023, especially when we think about, you know, prospects for war, that this is going to exacerbate the shortages that we see currently. And the Fed's monetary policy, their tightening posture, is only making it worse as well, because they can't do anything on the supply side. That needs to be something that's addressed either with the supply chain bottlenecks, or most certainly by investing capital investments into energy, into commodities for the things that we need for our economy to run and function. There has to be a big turn of some sort and for us to get there. That being said, it sounds like commodity prices are probably going to remain elevated in this type of environment. What do you see for the general stock market outlook? We're seeing a bear market rally right now, is how most people are characterizing it. Is that where you would side? Is this a bear market rally? Do you think that this is a sustainable bottom?
It's not a bear market. It is simply a correction. And we'll probably ideally correct into the first quarter of next year and then begin to rebound. But you have to understand the dynamics behind what's going on. And the U.S. was bankrupt in 1896. That's when J.P. Morgan had to lend $100 million in gold to the Treasury to bail us out. After World War I, we became the financial capital. After World War II, we had 76% of the entire world gold reserves. Why? Because Europe blew itself up twice. As that happens, and you have risks of war in Europe, I mean, tanks are running down the street. Are you going to leave your money in the bank? I mean, it jumped on whatever plane it could or every boat, and it all came to the United States. That's really why we had the Roaring Twenties, because the money came here from the First World War. And then it was kind of like the dot-com bubble, but it was automobiles. So Europe was in shambles. And then Europe was just borrowing money and rearming itself, really, instead of rebuilding its economy. And then they defaulted again in 1931, sovereign debt default. I recommend reading Herbert Hoover's memoirs for 1931. He said, capital acted like a loose cannon on the deck of a ship in the middle of a hurricane, shooting off in every which direction so fast, they couldn't form a committee quick enough to even figure out what was going on. But all these countries were defaulting on their debts. And that's really what wiped out 9,000 banks. Government debt, even today, is at least five times the amount of money in equities. In some cases, 10. So what creates a depression is not the stock market decline. It is the bond collapse. You wipe that out, you just took out all the pension funds. But I said, if bonds collapse, there goes Social Security. All right. So it's far more serious on the fiscal side. And that's what the Fed cannot control. All right. The Fed can, Powell can stand up and jawbone all he wants. The Democrats are not going to listen. They have elections coming up. They have signed on to this climate change agenda. They're not going to say, oh, gee, so sorry, we made a mistake. Politicians never do that. They don't. It's like, you know, with all the vaccines. And will they ever stand up and say, oh, gee, sorry, a number of people were seriously injured and some died? Not everybody, you know, I have a guy that works for me. His whole family are extremely allergic to any vaccine. Even they can't even take a flu shot. We're not all the same. You know, you can't mandate everybody has a vaccine and some people just, you know, roll over and die.
Yeah, I had a friend who has Guillain-Barré, and Guillain-Barré was one of the pre-existing conditions where it's recommended not to get the vaccine if you had that. And unfortunately, their work would not recognize that, even though it was clearly late. So like you say, I mean, there are situations and health conditions where you shouldn't be vaccinated. And it's that is known and understood. And yet somehow that was not communicated. There was such pressure, politically speaking, or social pressure, that, you know, you have to do it, even if you're putting your own life at risk. Yeah, it was pretty ridiculous.
Yes. And you know, the government will never come out and say, gee, sorry, we were wrong in that. It's just not going to happen. They do not ever admit a mistake. That's just that. That's it. So what you have to understand is that as the geopolitical tensions rise in Europe over Ukraine, the money is going to continue to come here. That's why the dollar has been going up. All right. The dollar has been in a bull market. They've been buying the dollar, buying, you know, short-term debt, because it's the first time they can even earn interest. But eventually that will shift over to the stock market probably next year. So that's why I said we're only in a correction. This is not a bear market. You know, that's what made the United States what it is. It was war in Europe, you know, twice.
Yeah. So, you know, if we look at the S&P, we're currently around 20% off of the highs. It appears that we're seeing, you know, a year-end rally commence off of pretty extreme sentiment, pessimism towards the stock market. There was a lot of selling that had taken place before we got to that bottom, just around 3,500. So, you know, we're seeing a rally from there. Some people are saying that we're setting up for a year-end rally, but it sounds like you think we could see a further correction, perhaps after this year-end rally, however long that commences into the first quarter of next year.
We still have the elections. Now, I can tell you what's going to happen, and we see civil unrest rising dramatically next year. You already have 90 countries with civil unrest, right? You know, because of the rise in energy prices. Regardless of who wins, neither side is going to accept it this time.
So this is civil unrest here in the U.S. and globally.
Yes, globally. You also have to understand that because energy and everything else, the commodities are priced in dollars. So as the dollar goes up, although it looks to us that a commodity is going down, to them it's still risen. And you go to a lot of these third world countries, they don't have electric cars or even social programs. And you raise the price of energy to them, and they, you know, they can't put food on the table for their children. That's why you see civil unrest in 90 countries now protesting over energy prices. 90.
Yeah, it's amazing. And food prices too, as well, of course.
Yeah, I mean, this is, you know, Russia was a major source for fertilizer.
Right, and Ukraine for wheat and all sorts of nickel. I mean, there's lots of different things that came out of that region. So it's massive disruption. So it sounds like you're saying you expect capital to continue flowing into the U.S., and that's going to keep U.S. markets bid up, that we're not going to see the big, perhaps, you know, major bear market. And even if we were to see a recession, and I believe you had said last time that you believe we were in a recession just in real terms when you look at inflation, even within the midst of a recession, you know, that's when you would see some of these major bear markets where you could go down, you know, not just 30%, but 40, 50%. But it sounds like because of all of the tensions and the uncertainty that we see internationally, that's going to bid U.S. assets a bit higher than what we would normally see.
Yeah, I mean, look, a U.S. market went down 50%. You're going to have every foreigner saying, this is a fire sale. Thank you, I'll buy it. So I wouldn't count on that. I mean, foreign capital is coming here the same way as it did for World War One and Two.
And in that case, the dollar still being bid higher as well, because that's a reflection of capital fleeing into U.S.
Yeah, I mean, look at what happened to the pound, the euro. I mean, the euro was once $1.60.
So at this point, I think we've covered quite a bit of territory here today, Martin. I want to thank you for, you know, sharing your thoughts on all of this. It's a crazy environment. Again, I mean, you've just given so many amazing, prescient forecasts on our show and time and again. So any opportunities here that you are alerting people that you see emerging in the markets currently, you know, whether or not that is to as a buying opportunity or a selling opportunity or otherwise, any major trends that you think investors should really be looking at?
Oh, we do the whole world, so it's kind of hard to do that. But we have a conference coming up in a few weeks, and I'm just largely been preparing for that. It's very interesting times, and just pay attention to what's actually going on. But it's a global market, and we're all connected.
What would be the best way for our listeners to sign up for the upcoming conference, and where is it going to take place?
In Orlando, you can also get it virtually. Just go to our website, armstrongeconomics.com.
Perfect. All right. And we'll have a link out to that as well, where this interview is located on Financial Sense. Martin, it was a pleasure. We look forward to speak with you again.
Thank you. Take care.
So as always, very interesting comments from Martin Armstrong on the current environment that we are facing. Again, he doesn't see things improving much from a geopolitical standpoint when it comes to the war in Ukraine. And that, counter to what most people may think, he believes that overthrowing Putin would actually make things even worse and not better, since, as he said today, there are probably far more aggressive elements within the Russian political structure that would be more likely to use their large nuclear arsenal if necessary. That being said, as long as tensions remain high and the war continues between Russia and Ukraine, we are likely looking at prolonged shortages in energy and natural resources, which will keep commodity prices and inflation elevated. This is, of course, bad for global economic growth, not to mention the well-being and livelihood of billions of people across the world, which is a major reason why we are seeing a huge uptick in social unrest over high energy and food prices. But as we discussed today, this is a central banker's worst nightmare, because all they can do is affect the demand side by raising the cost of borrowing and tightening liquidity, but they can't do anything to fix the inflation caused by supply-related issues, whether that be from wars, zero COVID policies in China, or the attempts by governments to shut down the production and refining of fossil fuels. So, bottom line, as we warned in early 2020, the stage appears set for a prolonged inflationary environment, and in terms of the market outlook, the 1966 to 1982 stagflationary period may serve as a good analog of what to expect. During that decade-plus period, stocks moved in a largely sideways volatile fashion, favoring an active management strategy and a higher exposure to natural resources. That's what we are doing here at Financial Sense Wealth Management. To come on board or learn more about our investment strategy, you can give us a call at 888-486-3939 or go to financialsense.com and hit where it says Contact Us. I'm Chris Sheridan. Thanks for listening.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.